No, that's where I want
to
go.
That's where there's good fish.
Yep, good fish, bro.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't get there
Florida.
right now.
You want to search your notes?
He's got to win the lottery to go to where he wants to go. That's how expensive it is. Millions. He's got to win the lottery.
All right, folks, good morning. Oh, it's stuck. Yeah, it's probably that battery's done. All right, that just might mean we'll be here for a long time.
That's game time.
How will you know when it's game time?
I never watch.
We collected all the watches upon entry. Oh, okay.
I was playing this on Kansas City. I was kidding. We're not even a fan. We used to have a thrift shop.
If they win, they can work something.
Wow, we didn't get very far last week.
No.
Did we do anything? All right. So, in 30 seconds or less, since the divine energy comes into the world through the land of Israel, and the whole purpose of creation is for us to make the world a godly place through the 248 positive commandments, 365 negative commandments, which relate to the 248 divine organs of the king, meaning God's manifestation in creation, and the 365 represent the major veins and sinews, arteries. And in observing those commandments, we draw down the divine light into the world. And since many of the commandments, the greater majority of the commandments, are connected to the land of Israel, so therefore Israel is such a holy place, right? That's if everything comes into this universe through the land of Israel, so therefore Israel is a very holy place. Maybe that's an oversimplification, but that's the punchline. Okay. Right, as we discussed at length, the negative forces in the world all need to ultimately nurture from holiness, and their access is through the holiness. And they necessarily don't and can't approach it in a straightforward way. So they have to approach it from a backhanded way, and that's why there's so much negativity. I won't tell you what I'm about to tell you because we'll be here for a half hour. But it'll come back. Okay. Huh? All right. So we are on page, the one that's stapled, 17. He says like this. So if we recall, the question of this discourse is why the spies, they were leaders of the tribes. And how is it possible that these leaders of the tribes fell to such a low spiritual level coming into the land of Israel and coming back with such a negative report, to the extent that they ultimately died and the Jewish people were stuck in the desert for 40 years? So what gives? What was the story with these spies? So the Alter Rebbe continues, based on what we understand the spiritual nature of Israel to be, the spies were at an exceedingly high spiritual level. They were very holy. They were very, very high spiritual beings. They did not want to lower themselves to engage in physical mitzvah and physical actions. Shubachinas hamshachas are in Seif Baruch Hu Lamata, which, as we discussed, is the idea of drawing down divine light here below. Would you like a copy? Oh, you got a copy there? Okay. The mitzvahs, the action mitzvahs, the action commandments, as we discussed, is the channel by doing a physical mitzvah, we draw down the divine light into the world. But in order to do that, you got to do the physical mitzvah. The spies were very high spiritual beings. They were humans, but they lived in a different dimension. They were very spiritual, very holy. And they didn't want to have to lower themselves to engage in the physical reality in order to bring down divine light. V'amru al Eretz Yisrael, so what did they say? What was their complaint? What was their report? They said that Israel is a land, she'echeles yeshveh. It's a land that consumes its inhabitants. So what does that mean? What does that mean on a literal level? On a literal level, a land that consumes its inhabitants, it means we're consumed by our lives. We're consumed by work. We're consumed by, right? I mean, if you think about, you wake up in the morning, I don't know if you do, but I wake up in the morning and I have to calm myself down. Like the first thing I have to do is calm myself down. It's like, chill out. It's all going to be okay. You'll make it through the day, right? You wake up in the morning and it's like, whoa, there's so much to do. Like some days I wake up and I say, I wish I lived in the shtetl. Wake up in the morning, what do I got to do? I got to go daven, go milk the cow, come home for lunch. It's like, huh? Daven, go back and pick some wheat. Daven, right? What do we do today? We wake up in the morning and we got this thing and that thing and this email to respond to and that person to contact and that it consumes us. It literally consumes us, right? So here they were living in the desert, surrounded by the clouds of glory at day, the pillar of fire at night. I mean, it wasn't a bad life. They woke up and they didn't have to worry about their clothing. They didn't have to worry about food. They spent the whole day studying Torah. And now you want them to leave that environment to go into the land of Israel and start working the fields and dealing with physicality and mundane things. So that's on a literal level. But what's the mystical meaning behind that? They said like this: She'im yagili arin seif baruch hu lamata k'may lamayla yisbatlu mimitziusim lagamri. That if the result of doing the positive actions, the mitzvahs, in this physical world is going to bring down divine light into this world, so there won't be a distinction between this world and the upper world. As we've discussed, that when there is divine revelation, why the need for the channeling of divine light? Because if the divine light comes in a straightforward manner, we cease to exist, right? If God suddenly turns the light on, we literally are consumed by that light. There's no more us. There's only a divine consciousness. So if you do the mitzvah, if we do what God instructs us to do, we actually are engaged in the physical mitzvahs, it brings down the divine light, and then there's not going to be a distinction between below and above. This is going to be a place of divine revelation. And we will literally be consumed. And this is what it means that it consumes its inhabitants. Veratzulios, in the next page, b'midbar dafka, they wanted to remain in the desert. Now, the word midbar, which means the desert, also has the root word dibor, or daber, like vayedaber, like God spoke, vayedaber Hashem. Dibor means speech. In Song of Songs, King Solomon says, umidvarcha nava, and your speech is beautiful. What does that mean, and your speech is beautiful? Shuham shachas arin seif baruch hu lebechinas hadibor, bechinas malchus, bechinas eretz yisrael shelamayla. They wanted to bring down the divine speech, which is God's light, right? As we spoke that speech is about communication. It's about revelation, right? What is speech? Speech is me revealing what's inside my head and my heart. So speech is just a form of revelation. So when King Solomon says that your speech is beautiful, it means that the divine light is beautiful. The revelation of godly light is beautiful. And they wanted to draw down that divine light into the spiritual dimension, the spiritual sephira of Malchus. Malchus, I'll explain in a minute, corresponds, as we discussed, that there is the lower Israel and the upper Israel. Malchus, the divine spiritual sphere of Malchus, is the Israel that's above. Let me explain briefly what this means. So, for those not familiar with the 10 spheres, there are 10 building blocks of creation, 10 spiritual building blocks of creation. These 10 building blocks of creation, once we step outside of God's essence, we already have fragmentation. And that fragmentation is part of God's master plan. And those are the 10 building blocks of creation. Now, what are these 10 building blocks? They're spiritual stuff. It's the spiritual DNA of all of existence. However, for the human mind to have some comprehension, we actually see how these 10 building blocks have evolved in the spiritual chain from one world to the next until they manifest in this physical reality. And we have the microcosm of the human being, the Olam Katan, the small world of the human being. And we look at this, the human being, and we're able to understand what those 10 building blocks are within the human experience. And as we discussed at length in the past, that when you look in a mirror, you have a reflection of what's in front of you. You have a reflection of yourself. But the matter, the physical matter of the material, is something altogether different. And that's important because even though we're looking at the person and we're understanding that we're made up of these 10 building blocks, and we're saying that we are a mirror for whatever is in the spiritual cosmos, it's not made up of the same stuff. But the best we have is the human experience, because that's our consciousness, right? So what is the 10 building blocks within the human consciousness? So we have, and for the purposes of this maimer, we're going to divide it into three. We have three intellectual components: chachma, bina, das, which is conception, gestation, and transition, if you would, or birth, right? There's the birth of an idea, the genesis of an idea. There's the development of the idea, and there's the application of the idea. Then we have six primary emotional components. Again, in very general terms, kindness, discipline, compassion, endurance, humility, and bonding. And then the third category is the manifestation, the action, where that shows up. Right, we can have the greatest thoughts and the greatest feelings, but it shows up in its external expression. There are three layers to external expression. Two of them are, one is thought, the other is speech and action. And generally, Malchus, the lowest of the 10 spheres, which is known as Malchus, which means kingship, nobility, ultimately that is, it's about external expression. Malchus generally is referred to as speech and sometimes referred to as action. Hopefully you got that. If you didn't, ask questions. Yes.
It's going to be tangential. You listed kindness and compassion separately. They sound pretty close.
They're related because compassion is a blend of kindness and discipline. So chesed, we discussed, I don't know if we discussed it in this discourse, but the idea that there is the concept of pure chesed, right? There's the idea of kindness as a thing into itself. Kindness is free-flowing. It's giving, giving, giving. It's all about giving. Gevura, discipline, is about holding back. Compassion is an analysis of that, that says this person may not be so worthy, and therefore I ought to hold back, but there's a reason to give them anyway. There's an overriding reason to give them anyway. So compassion is generally an external expression of giving. So it is related. You can also hear in compassion that there's some judgment there, right? That's why there's a need for compassion, because there's a judgment that might say, well, you know, what does compassion mean? Somebody comes to you and says, you know, I've fallen on hard times. So you can say, well, go get a job, right? That's the judgment. Or you can say, look, I understand you've fallen on hard times. I feel sad for you. I'm going to give you a leg up, but you got to go find a job, right? That's compassion, right? I'm making the analysis, and I'm going to help you anyway with the goal of helping you to get your leg up. But right now, I could be judgmental and say you don't deserve it because you're not working. Or I can say I'm going to help you so you can get your leg up and you can start working, right? So there is a judgment in there, even though the dominant is the compassion, which is the giving. There's another, it's also used as another way Tiferes is translated, which is then the name of the sphera, is harmony. It's also used, sometimes used as beauty or beautiful, right? So again, these different words convey different elements of what we were trying to convey, but we'll use the beauty one for a second. Chesed might be white, gevura black, right? White and black on their own serve a purpose, but it's not very beautiful. Take the right blend of white and black, and you can suddenly have a beautiful black and white painting, beautiful black and white photo, right? And if the right pieces come together, there has to be the right amount of each. And that's what Tiferes is. Tiferes is a balance where we bring these two things together and creates beauty. If somebody has a tendency to do kindness, then their acts, in other words, if that's what's ingrained in them, it's not so beautiful. You're just doing what you're wired to do. If you're of a nature to be more of a disciplinarian or more grounded like that, so the fact that you're more disciplined is also nothing to write home about. That's just how you're trained. But all of us have a struggle if we have to move to the other side. And that's where the compassion comes in. Any other questions? Yes. We take statements too.
Said on many occasions, you've used this thought speech in it. And it occurred to me that I can't really decide if they're supposed to be linked or independent, or is it sometimes just correct to think about it and then other times you need to say something, and sometimes you need so that they're hierarchical. I don't know.
It's you're making an important point. So first let me establish why we have these three things. What is the function of thought, speech, and action? So in the book of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe, who is the same author of this discourse, explains a very simple thing. I mean, it's a simple thing, sure. Mm-hmm. Very deep thing, but in very simple words. Who we are is who we are. Okay? In other words, at any given moment, all of us, if we were to write a description of our inner systems, right? It's just a reality. February 9th or 10th, whatever today is, 2024, we're all sitting in this room. We all are who we are inside is a result of everything that's happened to us from the moment we were conceived until this moment, right? Our genetics, our parents, our parental upbringing, the influences of the culture that we grew up in, things that happened yesterday, things that happened a year ago, 10 years ago, all of that shapes who we are at this moment. And you can't change that right now. You may not actually be able to change any of that. In other words, if you have certain tendencies, they may be stuck with you for the rest of your life. Yeah, we can work on it, but there's no guarantee that those are going to change. But we always have the capacity to control the three things that are the only way we manifest ourselves in the world. In other words, who we are is our inner system. The thought, speech, and action is our outer system. We can control what we think about, we can control what we say, and we can control what we do. Obviously, it's more difficult to control what we think about.
Yeah.
It's less difficult to control what we say. And it's, in a sense, the easiest to control what we do. But not necessarily it's easy to control what we do either. It's just easier to control what we do than necessarily what we think. But these three are the expressions, it's the tools or in the words of the Alter Rebbe, it's the garments through which the soul is able to manifest itself. If you don't have clothing, you can't go outside. So if you want to go outside, you need clothing. What's the clothing that the soul wears? The soul doesn't wear kindness. That's a feeling. The soul doesn't wear conception. That's an intellectual function. The soul doesn't wear endurance. That's an emotion. What does the soul wear? The soul wears thought, the capacity to think, the capacity to speak, and the capacity to do. And yes, they are hierarchical, because thought is more connected internally than is speech. Speech already is an expression, but speech is still ethereal. And action, of course, is much more tangible. So let's bring it back to the Maamar. So we have these 10 building blocks within the human experience. Chachma, Bina, Das, 3 intellectual, 6 emotional, and the 7th, and Malchus, which is the manifestation in action and speech and so on. If speech is revelation, King Solomon says that speech is beautiful. We're talking about drawing down divine revelation into the divine sphera, the last of the 10 spheros, which corresponds in the human experience to speech and action. And we're just going to focus on speech because that's what the Alter Rebbe is focusing on here, right? So just like we go through this whole internal system, right? And we go through the process of the 3 intellectual, we flow through the intellect and we flow through the emotions, and then it shows up in speech. In a similar way, the divine energy that's brought about through the study of Torah, which I think is where he's going to focus, draws down the divine light into the spiritual manifestation of speech, which is the lowest of the 10 spheros, the lowest of the 10 building blocks, which is Malchus. Again, what does that mean practically? So you're called upon to give a speech. I don't know. You're going to speak about Israel. So you have to take into account who's your audience. What's the message you want to convey to them? You have ideas. That's intellectual stuff, right? Whatever it might be a spiritual messaging, it might be a political agenda, whatever it might be. But you're not limited just to ideas. You can't get up there and in a monotonous tone deliver an intellectual idea. It's not going to move anybody, unless you're actually talking to a bunch of intellectual professors who are not looking to be moved. But if you have an agenda to move people somewhere, which I think everybody does ultimately, you got to put some feeling into it. Now, what's the feeling? Depends what the agenda is. If you're trying to move people closer to Judaism or to Torah or to God, there's going to be one type of emotion. If you want to rally troops to go and demonstrate or whatever, you're going to have a different emotion, a different tone, right? So the emotions become part of that equation of where an idea is going to be manifest. Then you come in front of the room and you deliver your talk. So what do we just go through? We went through a process. By the way, not everybody necessarily spends all the time analyzing what's going to happen. In fact, I think for the most part, good speakers have the content, and as they build their speech, they know it kind of flows more naturally what they're trying to do. But if we're analyzing, like, what was the process here? What are the different components here? There's an idea. There's an intellectual idea, the Chachma Bina Das, the first 3. There's an emotional evaluation, which on some level involves all 6 primary emotions. And then there's its actual expression, which is the speech, right? In a spiritual manner, when we study Torah, we do mitzvahs, that the agenda of the spies was to bring the divine revelation from the top, to move this energy. Remember, the whole thing is just a metaphor for what we're experiencing in the building blocks in the spiritual cosmos, to bring the energy through the 3 intellectual, through the 6 emotional, and to be manifest in speech, in Malchus, in the lowest of the 10 building blocks. That was their agenda. They felt like we don't have to bring it down into this physical world. We can bring it into the spiritual world. In other words, if the agenda is Israel, let's bring it into the spiritual Israel. Why do we have to bring it into the physical Israel? Let's bring it into the spiritual Israel. Eretz Yisrael, Shalemaila, the Israel that's above. And any questions on that? Yes.
Each thought and action, that sounds familiar for the villain. Like it connects though. Is it thought, heart, and the action of your hand? Is there any connection here?
Yes, ultimately, because the objective of tefillin, it's actually a great question, and I think it's very much aligned, because what is the objective of tefillin? It's to actually translate what we're going to do, right? When I mean do, I mean in all three dimensions, thought, speech, and action. In other words, where we have capacity to control. So in the Siddur, in the prayer book, the Alter Rebbe, the author of Tanya, the author of this discourse, has a, and he brings this down in the Code of Jewish Law, a meditation that one should have before putting on tefillin, which is to think about God's actions in creation, God's actions in the Exodus from Egypt, to guide us, to unify ourselves, to connect ourselves with God, so that it translates down into how we think and what we, not how we think, but what we think and what we do and what we say. So that's a nice parallel there. Other questions? You're itching to ask. Ask, and we'll try not to take up a big portion. I can't do anything in one sentence, but try.
Israel and Shemayim, and also talk on behalf of the spies, what they were thinking. I know there's oral tradition and there's other stuff. It's just.
Yeah, so first of all, that's why he's a Rebbe. That's why he's the Alter Rebbe. But a lot of these principles are taught in Kabbalah and Zohar and passed down from generation to generation. I said it flippantly, but I mean that a Rebbe has access to this information. But the nuances come from various different Kabbalistic traditions. We know, by the way, that the Baal Shem Tov studied with Achiah HaShiloni, right? The Baal Shem Tov studied with the prophet Achiah HaShiloni. Are you familiar with that story? Vaguely. All right, so that's, again, Rebbes have that, especially the Baal Shem Tov, who is the transmitter of much of this, a lot of the Hasidic principles to the Maggid of Mizrich. They had a very unique access to the spiritual cosmos. There's we're teaching a course right now called Advice for Life. And the question, the premise of the course is why do people go to Rebbes to get advice on mundane matters, on medical questions, on business questions? So and the short answer to the question is that when you have the spiritual eyesight, when you have the spiritual vision, you see in the physical reality, you see the spiritual structure. Right, the whole world is a creation of Torah, of God, who looked into the blueprints of the Torah and created the world. So when you're an architect and you look at a building, you say, oh, I see that, I see that mathematical equation there, I see that geometrical, that if you're an architect, you can see that. If you're a spiritual architect, if you have a spiritual eyesight, you can see in the reality of the physical world what's going on, let alone if you start looking at the Torah, right, you start seeing a different dimension there. So it's not actually novel. I mean, it's impressive, but it's not novel. Because each of us, right, we all actually experience this idea of living in different dimensions at different times and different experiences, right? We all walked into this room and we all actually are having different experiences. And each of our experiences in this moment is shaped by varying different perspectives and how we show up in this dimension. So if you have a spiritual capacity, when you look at Torah, when you look at another person, you see something different. And the more refined we are, the more that becomes our go-to place, and our capacity to tap into that. Now, obviously, Rebbes do that on a completely different dimension, but that's the core principle. Like I said, I can't do anything in one sentence. All right. Any other questions? All right, let's move on. So the question is, why is this Israel that's above, that they're bringing this divine light into, why is it called Eretz Yisrael Shelemaila? Why is it called the land of Israel that's above? Just call it Israel that's above. The land is a reference to the physical world, right? So if we're saying that they are saying that, if the Alter Rebbe is telling us that they're bringing this light into the Israel that's above, so begs the question, why is it called land of Israel? So that's what the Alter Rebbe addresses now. He says, V'nikras b'shem b'chinas eretz, l'fi sh'b'chinas ha-tachtoyne sh'b'alokos, k'ma sh'kosev ha-aretz ha-doim ragli. It says in Isaiah, in Yeshaya, it says, ha-shamayim kisi, the heavens is my throne, v'ha-aretz ha-doim ragli, the land is my footstool. What do they call a footstool? It's called the, what's the official? Huh? An ottoman? Is that what it's called, an ottoman? Huh?
There are a dozen words.
Dozen words for it. Okay, ottoman, footstool, whatever the case is, it's where you rest your feet. So the heavens is the beginning of the revelation. Aretz, land, is where the revelation ends. Now, it doesn't mean it ends permanently, but in each dimension, there's a beginning and there's an end. We know there are four primary worlds, and each world starts with revelation, and then when that world's revelation ends, that lowest level becomes the beginning of the next world, or what's conventionally called Keser, the crown of the next world, right? So when Isaiah says the heavens is my throne and the earth is my footstool, he doesn't necessarily mean the earth. He means that within any dimension, the end of that dimension is the end of that revelation. And accordingly, there is in the spiritual cosmos where there is an end to the divine revelation of that dimension. And that's what's called Eretz Yisrael Shelemaila, the supernal land of Israel. Furthermore, Uksiv, it's written, Hashem bechachma yasad aretz, that Hashem established the aretz, the land, with chachma meaning wisdom. And the Zohar says, Abba yasad barta, that the father established the daughter. Explain in a second. Bechinas hadibor, the daughter being the level of speech. Dvar Hashem, the word of God, shashar shemechachma, which originates in Chachma. What this means like this. We're mixing metaphors here, but these are the two primary metaphors that manifest themselves in the spiritual cosmos. One is the idea of conception and birth, and the other is the references to thought, speech, and action. In conception, you have the father's contribution, the gestation which takes place in the mother, and then you have birth. In the spiritual cosmos, you have chachma and bina, chachma being conception, the birth of an idea, bina being understanding, the development, the gestation of an idea, das, knowledge, is where conception and gestation, or where the events of reproduction takes place. As the Alter Rebbe says at the end of chapter 3 in Tanya, he says that we find in the Torah, when the Torah talks about reproduction by Adam and Eve, it says, "And Adam knew Eve," right? Why does it say Adam knew Eve? We're not, the Torah is not bashful. There's many places where the Torah is pretty explicit. Huh?
He knew her biblically.
Okay, so he knew her biblically. The idea of knowing biblically comes from there. But what does that mean, he knew her biblically? Well, we know what it means literally. But the question is, why does the Torah use that language of knowing, right? We have other places where the Torah is very explicit of what happened. The Torah is teaching us something, and it's teaching us something about knowledge, about knowing, that if you want to know something, it's not enough just to process chachma and bina, just wisdom and understanding. Knowledge requires great effort. He uses that one has to fix their mind, they has to implant their mind with great intention in order for something to become knowledge. Elsewhere, the Alter Rebbe explains that what is knowledge? Knowledge is actually awareness or feeling or experience, right? You know, we collect information and we may be even invested in a particular area of knowledge, right? In a particular wisdom. And it's an idea. And then you go through life's experiences, and then suddenly you say, oh, now I get it. That's what it's all about. Right? You may have had the information in your head for a long period of time, and then suddenly something happens in your life and you say, oh, now I feel it. Now I know it. What do you mean, now I know it? You didn't know it before? No, I had information before, but now I know it. Now I'm actually in the experience. So that's the beginning. That's reproduction, conception, gestation. What's the result of this process? Birth. What are we trying to birth? So in a classical sense, a son and a daughter. The son is the six emotional attributes. We're not going to get into it, but in Kabbalah, they're called Ze'er Anpin, which is a masculine term. Okay? And then Malchus, which is a feminine term, is the daughter. Okay? So you have the boy that's born and the girl that's born from this conception and gestation. The girl that's born, the daughter that's born, is Malchus, is the lowest of the 10 spheros. Where does Malchus originate? It originates in Chachma. It originates in Abba. It originates in the Father. That's where conception begins. And within the Father, it originates in the highest dimension of the intellect. Are we good with that? Do we need more information on that? Just in terms of the metaphor here. We're going to bring it back to the discourse. We're good with that? Or should I elaborate? I'm getting silence. I think I need to elaborate. Okay. Every child, right? A child, each of us come from some parents, right? Whether we like them or not, we all originate with our parents. And within our parents themselves, we start in the father. Yes, we start in the father and the mother, but the activity, without getting too graphic, starts with the father. Now, furthermore, our rabbis teach us that one cannot reproduce except if their mind wishes to reproduce. And there's all kinds of halachic ramifications around that. Particularly for men, if they're engaged in a forbidden relationship, the questions about what is their liability becomes becomes different based on how they show up in the experience. Because you can't passively show up in an experience and actually succeed at an illicit relationship. So there are times where a man may be forced into something. Again, they may not necessarily be liable from a technical standpoint, but there may be some other components there that they need atonement for. Yeah, I guess I can get explicit for a minute. I'll give an example. If a man is engaged in an act of intimacy, And one of the prohibitions is that a woman, when she is in her period, when she's menstruating, there's not allowed to be intimacy. When a woman finishes her period, she goes to the mikvah, and then intimacy is permitted again. What happens? And there's rules about making sure that if a woman's period is suspected, that there has to be an internal examination to make sure that they don't engage in this intimacy, and then find out that she's begun her period. What happens if a man is being intimate, and while they're being intimate, the woman says, you know, I feel like my period started. So the halacha is he has to wait there. He has to wait in the experience until, as the expression in the law is, until the organ dies. We'll leave that to your imagination. Why? Because there's an act of pleasure in removing the organ while it's active. So the whole idea of causing the organ to be active starts in the brain. What is the point of all that? That is to say that the seed that is produced originates in the brain. Furthermore, the Zohar says that the moisture that's in the seed originates in the brain. In other words, there's actual moisture from the brain that goes through the body, goes through the spinal cord, and ends up in the actual seed that then produces, when it fertilizes the egg, produces the new life. Which means, again, the punchline of all of this physical analysis is that the child that's born, their very being originates in part in the brain of the father. So now, when we're looking at the daughter in the context of this discourse, who's offspring of the father, she is actually a manifestation of the chachma of the father, of the intellect of the father. In other words, there's a direct relationship, not just they're connected. She's actually a result of that. Which, by the way, if you, back to your question, how does the Alter Rebbe know this, right? The experience is visible in the human condition. You have people who never met their father, and yet they have this deep need. They may have been raised in an adopted home that was completely loving, but there's a deep need to connect with that origin. Why? Why the great need to connect with that origin? Because that is you. There's a direct connection there, right? There's a very deep connection, which, by the way, is also why there's so much tension between children and parents, because we have a hard time being with ourselves, right? And there's a deep connection there. If it was just somebody who made a contribution, you know, okay, goodbye, move on. You know, it's like they just contributed and, you know, sei gesund, and now it's okay, but it brought me into the world. I don't need anything from you anymore, right? But because we're deeply connected, we can't just sever our connection. We can't just say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, you brought me into the world and I don't need anything from you anymore. We try to do that, but it doesn't work very well. That's why kids and parents are constantly fighting when they're 10 and 20 and 50 and 100. Their fighting continues. I remember a story years ago. There was an older gentleman who came to services, and I wanted to call him up to the Torah. He was like 86. He was an old man, and he was, not that 86 necessarily has to be an old man, but he was an old man. And I wanted to call him up to the Torah. So the tradition is you call people up, you know, the person, Ben, their father's name. So I ask him what his name is, and he says, my name is whatever, Shimon Ben Rachel. He tells me his mother's name. So I said, and your father's name. He tells me again, Shimon ben Rachel. I said, what was your father's name? He says, Rachel. So I finally called him up, Shimon ben Rachel. I said Rachel quietly, and then I said, you know, Ben Avraham or something. Afterwards, I found out what the story was. When he was 15, his father had an affair. He was 15, his father had an affair. Father wasn't, you know, I didn't know the guy, so I can't speak ill of him, but he says his father wasn't a nice guy. But here he's 86 and he can't even utter his father's name. I'm not judging him. I'm trying to portray how deeply the connection is, that we're so deeply connected that we can't just ignore it. We either love it, we hate it, or we fight it, right? We only do that with things that we're deeply connected to. If we could care less, we just walk away from it. But because we're so deeply connected, because we are directly connected, because we are them, We are an expression. We are a manifestation of our parents. We can't just be passive about it. So Malchus, which is the daughter, is a manifestation of Abba, of the Father, of Chachma. Directly, it is the manifestation. The heavens is my throne. It's the beginning of the revelation. And the earth is my footstool. That's the end of the revelation. That's where it shows up in its manifestation. So, and this is why, just to contextualize, this is why the Alter Rebbe is telling us that the spies wanted to bring down the divine light into Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel that's above. Why is it called land? Because in that land, meaning that's the end, that's the footstool, that's where the divine revelation ultimately manifests itself in the supernal, in the spiritual cosmos. The Alter Rebbe continues. The Chanira Mimashal Hatinik Shekolz Man Shein Le Meichen Diyanika B'Shlemus Afal Pi Sheyesh Le Kol Oisius Pshutim Afal Pi Kein Eni Yachal Ladabar Letzarefa Oisius. We see in the analogy of a toddler that a toddler, even though his mind is fully developed, and he has the physical ability to produce the sounds of the letters, nonetheless, he is not able to speak and to organize the letters into words. Why? The ability to formulate words is not a function of the machine. It's not a function of the machine. It's a function of chachma, the function of this quality of chachma that allows for the words to be formulated. Fascinating story. There's a couple who have a child who has, not even sure what his condition is, but he doesn't talk. He doesn't talk. But he has a chart that he's able to point letters. And we see this family often. And they sent, the boy sent, he's a teenager, they sent us a letter. He sent us, the parents printed it out, but he typed up a letter for us and he sent it to us. It's beautiful, very fascinating. So he's able to formulate letters, right? So the chachma is there, obviously. In this context, the ultimate manifestation of chachma is in speech, right? If you can formulate letters in your head, that's great. And that's why he has a condition. But ultimately, the manifestation of the letters needs to show up in speech. That's a chachma quality. That's a chachma component. It's not just a function of the machinery. So again, spiritually, what does that mean? That when chachma manifests itself in speech, it shows up in malchus, it shows up in the actual expression of speech. Because the chachma is there before. But when the chachma goes, in other words, it's like people who have, you know, unfortunately, sometimes people, again, using the metaphor, sometimes people have all the working components, right? A woman has eggs and a man has sperm and they're able to fertilize the eggs, but the process doesn't finish, right? It doesn't end, doesn't show up in living humans. Again, whatever that means in the metaphor, the idea is that you can have the right machinery, but if you don't have that core, whatever that core is, what we're calling chachma, it doesn't show up in its ideal format, which is speech. Okay, any questions on this? So, good. So what is the agenda of the spies? The spies don't want to bring down the light into the physical world because in the physical world, they will lose their identity. In other words, the lower, when God is manifest in this physical consciousness, then there's no distinction between the physical reality and the spiritual reality. But they understood that their job is to bring down the divine light. So they said, we're going to bring down the divine light into, we're going to cause this process of chachma to manifest itself in speech. But the speech that's going to be manifest is not going to be physical speech. It's not going to be physical revelation. It's going to be in the spiritual world of speech. In Malchus, that's we're going to cause the divine light to go from here to here, not from here down to here. In other words, we're duplicating the process. We're just doing it in the spiritual cosmos. Now, the whole discussion of the Eretz, the land of Israel above, is to make the point that the revelation that is ultimately manifest in Malchus, in the spiritual dimension of speech, is rooted in the highest level of these 10 building blocks. In other words, that in a sense, mission accomplished. We took the highest and we caused it to be revealed in the lowest. Granted, it's in that world, not in this world, but that's the process. We're gonna continue with that idea. Any other questions on this? Deep stuff, yeah.
Kind of going back a few steps earlier, and you don't have to answer it now, but it just keeps reverberating with me. Endurance is an emotion. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that.
Why do you have a difficulty with endurance being an emotion?
Oh, you could have endurance. You could be happy and have endurance about being happy, but actually endurance. I thought that's like a noun, not a verb, or the other way around. Like it's something you do, not something you feel.
Okay, good. So let me tell you how I understand endurance. So the word in Hebrew is netzach, which actually can more correctly translate as victory, right? But the word endurance, actually, if you think about it, hopefully you'll connect with what I experience in the word endurance. So I want to lose weight. I mean, I do, but it's an example. So what am I going to do? I was speaking to somebody Friday night. We had a Hebrew school Shabbat dinner, a fellow who does training. He's a trainer. And every time we see each other, he says, so, you know, what are you up to? So I told him what I'm doing. So then I said to him, is that a good routine? So he says, you know what they say, what's the best exercise regime? The one that you're doing. In other words, the one that you are doing, as long as you're doing it, that's a good one. That's the best one. Because so many people talk about exercise and don't do it, right? So I want to lose weight. I want to eat healthy. So I'm committed to this process, whatever that process is. And I do it for a day. I do it for 2 days. And then I show up and there's a really good piece of chocolate cake. What's going to keep me from eating that chocolate cake? That's endurance. The endurance is my resolve, my inner resolve to stay the course. That's not an intellectual idea. It may be fed by the intellect, which is appropriate, but ultimately it's an inner feeling that I am committed to this process. I am committed to the experience of staying the course. Stuff's going to come my way. Stuff's going to try to derail me, but I am going to stay that course.
From that determination, whereas I might say endurance is an ability. Not having the chocolate cake versus, you know, being able to walk from one town to the next because you have to get there. One is mind over matter, and wow, he did something he didn't think he could do. And the other thing is training, being disciplined, knowing what to expect, hydrating yourself and accomplishing.
So those are actions. Let's use your example. Somebody going from, they got to get to the next city, right? And they've run out of water and their training has all but expired. What is going to keep them pushing on? What's going to keep them pushing on?
Determination and endurance interchangeably.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not a linguist or a grammarian, but determination to me sounds more like a decision. That I'm making a decision to. That's where the determination. But if that connects with you emotionally, that works for me too. For me, it's like I'm going to stay this course. I can't give up. That's deep inside of me. That's a feeling, right? That's not, my brain will help me get there, but it's a deep feeling of I am committed to this. You know, I'm being thrown off course. Everything I've been trained with is falling by the wayside, right? What's going to keep me on the course? That's that deep feeling of I'm going to do this. So whatever word you use, that's the core of it.
Isn't it the trait? It's just the trait that pushes you forward, right? In my mind.
Say that again. It's a what?
It's the trait. It's like the thing that it's the trait that pushes you forward. It's just like each one has its own ingredient. That ingredient is to push you forward.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And by the way, let's remember that in a healthy format, nothing is one dimensional, right? Endurance doesn't live on its own. It lives with the intellect. It lives with other emotions that lend support. In other words, it might be, I want the prize at the end, right? So therefore I'm going to endure even though, you know, or it could be, I can't fail this because what, you know, I have too much shame around that. So therefore I'm enduring. So what, there are other emotions that play into it, but which is ultimately the unique structure of the divine spheros, which is that they're all at various different dimensions, how they intertwine with each other. But ultimately that's how it translates down. So let's bring it back, at least to close on a messaging here. So v'ratzu ha-meraglim shiyu kol ha-mshachas mechach me'ila lebechines dibor Eretz Yisrael shalamayla she-shom yesh gam kein beis ha-migdash v'yushalayim b'chol ha-bechines. So we're going to leave you wanting, but the point is that the spies didn't want to have to deal with all of this work in this physical world. They wanted to accomplish all of this in the spiritual cosmos. That was their agenda. They wanted to bring divine light into the spiritual worlds. It's not such a difficult concept to understand. They were mistaken, but it's not such a difficult concept to understand, right? Who wants to be involved in all the stuff that we have to be involved with every day, right? You know, there's this notion. There's a reason why the lottery is, you know, I don't know what it's at this week, you know, 300 million, 400 million, right? How many dollars are being spent to purchase tickets? What do people want? You have one for Chabad. I appreciate that.
You're on the list.
I'm on the list. Good. Top of the list. But what's that all about? There's this notion that, oh, I'll just win the lottery and then I don't have to do all that stuff. What am I going to do? What am I going to do if I don't do all that stuff? I'll read, I'll vacation, I'll travel, I'll spend time with my kids, I'll study, whatever, all the other stuff. In other words, the stuff that doesn't involve me. The spy said the land consumes its inhabitants. Life is consuming. I'd rather do all this stuff in a spiritual cause, on a spiritual dimension. And I don't mean this at all in a negative way, but people go to school, they go to college, they get these amazing degrees, and then they don't actually use them. Why? Because it's hard. And you try to take whatever it is that you learned and use it in some other way that doesn't... This is the tension of our conscious reality, is that we don't want to have to engage in the actual work. Not because we're lazy, but because it's hard and it consumes us. Think about the things that are really important to you. How much time do we have available to us in a given day to spend on them? Very little. So if there was a way in your imagination that you can get to that same place without doing the hard work, you would do that. And that's what the spies wanted. They said, if the whole objective here is to bring godliness down, we'll do it. But we're not going to do it down here. We're going to do it up here. We're doing it in the spiritual dimension. Next time, I don't know if next week, the subsequent weeks, eventually, when we get there, we're going to find out why they were wrong.
Is it possible they didn't have the confidence? Is it possible they didn't have the confidence that they could do it in that area? Do it in here, down here? I mean, it's almost like that's a kind of makes me think that They can do it in one area, but they've been so sure they can't do it. Well, but maybe they
so where does confidence come from? Some of it comes from faith. In other words, we can grow up in a home where our parents don't nurture the confidence, and maybe even do negative, right? You know, the classic, you know, the parents always telling the child they're not doing good enough. But there are people who grow up with that kind of lack of self-confidence that find confidence, right? Where's the confidence come from? It comes from a recognition that who are we in truth? Who are we in truth? In truth, we are a manifestation of the divine. And being a manifestation of the divine, nothing can stop us, right? I mean, we see what's going on in Israel right now. Israel, the whole world is telling Israel all of the negatives about Israel. And Israel, for the first time, is saying, well, we don't have a choice. We have to do this. We have to have the self-confidence because it's about survival at this point, right? So what is it? What were they lacking? Moses told them, this is your job. God, I work for God. God said, we're going into the land of Israel. Why wasn't that enough for them? Why wasn't that enough for them? So we have to understand what that's all about. But you got to come back next week. All right. Yeah. Every week's a cliffhanger. Even when we finish, it's a cliffhanger.